From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with author and college freshman Jordan Lyons.
And I'll talk with ceramic artist and potter Morgan Bosler. Plus, Matt Sosi joins us with the Born Again Floozies.
And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Newly published author Jordan Lyons has realistic expectations for his literary debut. "I'm sure it will have all the mistakes of a first novel," he says. "I think I'll get better. I'm only 19. Otherwise occupied with the typical concerns of freshman life at the University of Indianapolis, Lyons has written a book of historical fiction titled The Philadelphia First Ward Horror. The book is based on the true story of the largest mass murder in Philadelphia history, which took place in 1866. Travis DiNicola spoke with Jordan about his new book.
Jordan, welcome to Art of the Matter.
Hi, thanks a lot.
Pleasure to have you here today. I must say, just first off, congratulations. I'm impressed. You're 18?
19, actually.
Okay. But, you know, to have your first book under your belt, that's a pretty big accomplishment.
Yeah, it feels good.
I bet. I want to start with sort of how this all came about, because this is a, you know, this historical sort of thriller fiction book, you know, but set, it's not set in Indianapolis. It's not set in present time. It's set in Philadelphia. It's set in the 19th century. You know, most people when they, you know, younger authors, you know, write their first book, it's, you know, much more autobiographical often that sort of thing. And I'm assuming that's not the case here.
No, not at all. Not at all. Philadelphia First Ward Horror, based on the largest mass homicide in Philadelphia city history, 1866, just post-Civil War. Eight people murdered, killed, axe murders, and there's only one survivor, and from his descendants. One happened to move to Indianapolis a few years ago and is an associate of my father's. And that's how I met this woman and became known to the Deering family, which the book is based on. And so after having heard about the story from the Deerings, I just decided to send a few excerpts their way of maybe how I would have written the story. And the rest is history, quite literally, because they really were impressed and enthused about my take on it. And it just kind of took off from there.
Well, let's start with just the fascination with the story, first of all. I mean, have you always been, you know, like into, you know, thrillers or horror stories? Or,
well,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a pretty gruesome story. As you said, an axe murder with six people?
Eight people. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the word horror is written pretty big there on the cover of the book, and that labels me as well as the book. I can't say I've had a fascination with horror all my life, but certainly the drama of the story appealed to me very much as a writer.
And the writing part, was this something, I mean, had you been in school working, writing short stories, working on other, you know, fiction or other writing before, you know, looking for a subject? Or?
Yeah, well, I'd had the desire to be a novelist since I think I was 12 years old was when I really got into some heavy reading. But this just kind of came suddenly. I hadn't really had my eye out for anything. I'd just been going along and taking some creative writing classes and poetry and things like that here or there. But when this came along, I found myself with a major project as well as school, as well as carrying a part-time job. And so I had to balance, you know, all the routines of daily life as well as just growing up and, you know, being a kid. So all that together, really, I mean, it worked out pretty well, I think, but, I mean, it was difficult.
So you were, a senior in high school when you started working on this, or?
Yeah, I started, actually, it was February of 2008, so it was my last semester there as a senior, and I finished last Christmas of 08, so just about 10 months.
That right there just sort of blows me away. Because it's like, here it is, your senior year in high school, and then also beginning of your freshman year in college. You're at University of Indianapolis now. Most people are out there, enjoying the summer before they go off to school. I mean, worrying about where you're going to college, sports or dating or hanging out. I mean, writing's a pretty solitary process.
Oh, most definitely. I think I enjoyed my summer in quite a different way. I spent quite a bit of time holed up and locked up in my room and away from the world and civilization, but that's just part of my own personal kind of writing process. But again, the horror of the story, I'm afraid that that's going to be my label. I'm really kind of a happy guy. I'm a nice guy, but, this is just a story I had, so I had to kind of adapt and kind of transform myself into the content of the story.
Well, so the horror of the story. Tell us a little bit more about the history of the story and what happened back in 1866.
Well, Philadelphia at that time was, along with the rest of the country, in shambles and disarray, and the economy was just awful. Society was not pretty. Everything was kind of nasty, and the story really, I think, captures that. As far as racism and the war, I show it in the book in kind of a different way. It's no longer just racism between colors of skin. It's now racism between backgrounds and ethnic groups. And you have, the French and the Dutch and the German and the Irish and the Pole and Swedes and things like that all kind of congregating here in Philadelphia. And that's really the reason for the murder. A farmhand, Anton Probst, a German immigrant, worked for Irish immigrants who were very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And his motivation for the murder was money, of course, which was never found. And it's a really cool aspect of the story is that this money that he was after is
the treasure it's referred to.
Yeah, that's right. That puts a nice spin on it. But really, there could be this such thing as treasure or some amount of money buried out there in the fields of Philadelphia still today that no one ever found. So
yeah, well, I was wondering about that. I mean, how much of that is true that you know of? I mean, that they're actually, because obviously, that's, as you said, it's the motivator in the book. It carries throughout so much of it. And I have to tell you, I've not finished reading it yet, but I was, the parts I was left wondering, is there actually a treasure there?
Yeah, it's very well documented that Christopher Deering, the head of these Irish farmers, had quite a bit of money which he would count out. And Anton Probst was present during these business exchanges, and he got to see this money firsthand. So he knew most definitely that it existed and it was real, but whether it's still there or not, I can't say.
Yeah, but you did do a lot of research on this. There's a lot of the historical elements. I mean, whether it be the setting, the language, just the feel of the place. I mean, that alone, not just writing the story, but just to do the research, had to be an enormous amount of work.
Yeah, I had huge stacks of paper sitting up in my room, but it was really quite humbling to see pretty authentic and genuine papers from 1866, just kind of sitting around and lazing in my room. So it was really phenomenal to get to work with those things, but it was really research within research, I'd say. I had a lot of collected facts collected by the Deering family over the years, and it was in my job to become acquainted with them better than even the Deerings were, and I now have all kinds of facts and numbers and things running through my head all the time. And I mean, it took me a while to get all the names and ages down of every family member and things like that, but now I know it like the back of my hand.
Did you keep like a big chart at all while you were working on this?
Or? I thought about it, and that might have been a better idea, because I did find that there were times I was rummaging through the papers to find a better date or a better street name or a person's name that maybe I'd misspelled or something like that. But really at the end of the day, it was about taking all that in, taking the story that I had created in my head along with the factual information and combining them into such a precise way. So it was really research within research, fictional storytelling, and then the combining of the two.
So how much of the story that you came up with, I mean, is what can you tell us as far as, where does your imagination begin here?
I kind of like this question because a part of me really wants readers to know and a part of me absolutely doesn't want them to know. But the majority of all the names and places and dates are right on, spot on with the information. I really say more of the context or the plot line would be my own creation or web weaving there. The idea of the treasure and the keys and things of that nature are certainly all my invention. But for the most part, it's all It's all true.
Did you go to Philadelphia at all while you were working on this?
Yeah, I had a chance last summer to go with some members of the Deering family and then my own family and see a lot of these places, which was really cool. That way I had, you know, from last summer on, to be able to picture these places in my mind when I wrote, and that was really helpful.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, as we mentioned, you're a freshman now, and just finished up your freshman year at University of Indianapolis.
Yep.
And so, you know, you start college with, you know, you're halfway through writing a book, plus you got everything else going on with college. What did your roommates, your friends think, like, you know, here's this guy who's working on his novel? You know, I mean, that's kind of wild.
Well, I kind of kept it a secret for the most part. You know, I only have a few close friends, as a lot of kind of loner writers do, and they really didn't ask too many questions about it. And really even my family, you know, they were very interested to see how it was going and things like that. But for the most part, I really kind of kept it to myself. And I've only just recently, with the release of the novel, really kind of come out. And it catches a lot of people by surprise, because a lot of those classmates I spent all year with had no idea I was working on a novel. And then when I had the signing at UIndy a few weeks ago, I had all kinds of people coming up to me and, you know, saying, like, hey, you wrote a book. You didn't say anything, but... I don't know. I just kind of preferred to keep it.
What about your professors? I mean, you're taking some writing classes, right? I mean,
yeah,
did
they
know you were working on that?
I'm actually a history major
at
UIndy, so I piqued a lot of their interests as well. But the same with them. I really didn't say too much about it, but I really had some great response from them, and really a lot of enthusiasm and encouragement from those guys over there.
Well, that's excellent. So what's next on your plate here?
Oh, I've got all kinds of things on the plate. I really didn't want to take a breather even for a minute, so I've got an anthology of short stories I'm working on that will hopefully be finished by the end of the summer. And then after that, I'm hoping to base a novel series on the protagonist in these short stories, something like that. So I figure people really like to get involved and attached to their characters, and that's really the core of my writing, is all character-driven and assessed and developed.
As far as influences for you, you mentioned, you know, that even when you were younger, you as a kid wanted to become a writer. Obviously, you're a reader, and so who's influencing your work as far as what you're who are you learning from?
I'm gonna have to thank my friend Kalen first of all, and give him a shout out. He's really been kind of the low-lying influence in all this. He's the one that gave me a book when I was 12 years old and really got me reading. And since then, I've read the same things over and over again, the books he gives me. And so I really got to thank him. But, you know, other than that, it's really, really my family. They always have to be first. I mean, everything, no matter what they do, watching them, you know, at their professions and, you know, what they have chosen to do with their lives has really been a big factor. And it's always played really well in my mind when I sit down to write and to work. I always think about, you know, how hard they work at their own jobs, and I try to take it as seriously as they do. But also, I have to thank the Kushners, Matt and Susan. They're the ones that gave me the chance to write this book, and they had a lot of faith in me. And the whole Deering family, as well as the Kushners, every time I sat down, I would remember that this wasn't just, you know, my story or something I was doing for fun, that it was commemorating a family that was lost. So I really took it quite seriously.
What about authors? Are there authors who influence your work? Or?
Well, some people might cringe when they hear this. Maybe they might think it's a little cliche, but definitely Shakespeare. I cannot get enough of him. I think every time, you know, you sit down to write, you have to have the goal in mind that you want to be as good as him, even if you know you can't. But Longfellow and Irving and Poe, definitely, and some of those darker guys. But also, I've really been influenced a lot by Alfred Hitchcock. You know, he's a film director, not quite so much the writer, but, you know, I feel writing a fictional work is a lot the same as making a movie. When you sit down, you got to think about each character and how they interact with every other character and everything in their environment and things like that. And that's the same thing directors have to do as well as writers. So I tend to really become fans of movie directors lately.
Travis DiNicola with author Jordan Lyons. His book, The Philadelphia First Ward Horror, is available at local bookstores. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Morgan Bosler is a ceramic artist and potter who had for many years an idea about how to honor people and pets who've passed on. Recently, this Indianapolis Art Center teacher launched her newest business called Maud Earn, and Sharon Gamble talked with Morgan about her career and how Maud Earn was born.
All right, I do want to talk about Maud Earn's, the business and the product, but I want to start with how you've had a long career, despite being young. You've had a long career as an artist. How did you know you were an artist? Where did that start?
Well, I always tell people that I started my art when I would make mud pies after a rain along the side of the garage. always just fascinated with what you could do with what you could find outside. You know, sticks, write with rocks, you know, line sticks up and make designs, draw on the sand, whatever, those kinds of things, make mud pies, cut leaves and place them in there and make patterns and that sort of thing, or lick leaves and stick them on a, you know, on a wall or something. And that's always just been, it's just part of me. I mean, it's four generations deep that I can trace back.
I was just going to say, there's probably a chromosome for it, but I'm guessing there's some family influence there.
Very much so. Very much so. And it goes really deep. My my grandfather was an incredible metalsmith, and some of his work is in Muncie. He did a lot of work for the Ball family. And there's some homes out in Golden Hill where he did a lot of the railing and that sort of thing. And then my mother and her sister, my Aunt Hatter, both went to art school. And my mother was really talented, but she ended up having 9 kids. So,
oh, my.
Yeah.
She had a whole other artistic outlet trying to raise the kids up well.
You betcha. And she was an incredible woman. And my Aunt Hatter was really a mentor to me because she also took ceramics, and that was kind of my natural instinct, and I learned over the years. And you can see her, you can see some of her in my work.
Now, I want you to say a little bit more about that, because there are many different ways to be an artist. Some people are more visual. Some people are more tactile.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about sculpting that draws you or maybe first attracted you?
Well, it's completely tactile. And it's immediate gratification.
Hmm.
Oh, I do something wrong. Oh, I just take that away and then I add back. Or, oh, look at that. That happened. If I just push this a little bit here, then look at this expression that I got. It's the three-dimensional part of it. Drawing is not something that I really excel at. I'm an amateur painter for sure. But I can build. I can see it in my mind built, and I spend a lot of time in my thought process on how I'm going to actually make the piece, how am I going to achieve what it is that I want to make, and then I jump into it.
So no sketches, just straight from that long cultivation process,
it's both.
Percolating process in your head to...
It's completely both. And it's one thing that really surprised me about a year and a half ago is that I started building these pieces, and here I thought they were just popping out of my head, and I was cleaning out going through some old books and stuff, and I found an old journal that I had, and I flipped through it, and like 5 years previous, I had drawn some pictures that looked almost exactly like what I had made. So here I'd forgotten about these images that were important to me.
They were germinating.
Yeah, and then once I had the opportunity to sit down and make them, they just came right out.
So how did the idea of taking your sculptural art and making an urn for a pet come?
For pet and for people. Well, what started was in 1999 when my mother passed away. For some reason, I have a temperament to be able to handle arrangements for people who have passed and can kind of hold things together. And
where are you in birth order?
Number 7 of 9.
Okay. Parents are pretty relaxed by that point.
And it's fun. But anyway, I really, my mother was such an incredible woman, you know. She had 9 children. She taught mental retarded children at the local Noble School here. And then she went to school in the evenings to further her career so she could, you know, bring more income to the family. And when she passed, for me to put her in something that was spun out of a piece of stone that looked like, you know, 20,000 other ones that are being made and distributed across the world was hard for me. It did not speak of her spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I've had a sister and a brother pass, and then I've had some close family friends that have passed, and when that started happening, I was like, I have to change this. I need to have a different option. And so I started building the urns for them. And then I thought, well, this is what I want to do.
If you have this impulse, somebody else does too. Mm-hmm. Many other people do, mm-hmm, too.
And it's really about bringing something. When you love somebody so deeply, and they have made such an impact on your life that way, when you say goodbye to them, and whether it's a pet or a person, it's kind of one of the last things you can do to celebrate,
mm-hmm,
you know, and in the purpose of these urns also is that they're really sculptures or pieces of art. So when they sit in your home, if you decide to keep them in your home, they really look like a piece of art. They're very organic in shape. They're very mellow. They have a wonderful tactile feel to them. They're inviting.
Very serene.
They're very serene.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And kind of adobe. Some people kind of say adobe-ish, but that's a lot of people, you know, see it differently. I mean, everybody, when you look at art, it's very subjective.
Sure.
But
and you work in different materials or in different finishes.
Oh, yeah. There's different finishes, and there's all different size ones. And it's to celebrate them. And, you know, and you can keep them in your home, and it doesn't look like you have your relative sitting on the mantle.
Right.
You know, or your pet sitting there on the mantle or on the bookshelf. It's really a piece of art first.
So it's a private story. It's a private relationship still, unless or until you choose to share it.
Yes, very much.
Mm-hmm. Are you distributing any way beyond your website yet? Or do you want to?
Yes, I do want to, and I think that's going to be an important part of the growth for me. And I have been putting together my media package just recently. I have samples that I'm going to send out and that sort of thing. And also, you know, having wonderful opportunities like this, mm-hmm, to reach more people. I think that, you know, that all really helps. And, yeah, I have to go for it.
I have an emotional question for you. How do you, you may have already answered this because you said somehow you have the capability of staying calm and doing arrangements and so forth. Mm-hmm. When someone contacts you, obviously their loss is fairly fresh or they wouldn't be, unless they're pre-planning for themselves. But mm-hmm, how do you not become emotionally involved in someone else's loss?
Well, I think that's something that will grow with time. I do get emotionally involved to a certain extent. But I also look at ever after as not something that is really, really horrible. You know, for me, your spiritual self goes way beyond whatever's left behind. And yes, I feel for the people who are still there, the ones that have just gone through this really tough journey or have started on a journey that's going to take a while for them to heal.
Sure.
And I try and handle them one by one, you know, on an individual basis. But you do have to be careful, because you don't want to end up getting too close.
Sure, you have to have a little reserve there.
You have to have, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You teach as well as doing your own art.
Yes, I do. Yes, I'm kind of proud. I finally took a teaching position over at the Indianapolis Art Center. I don't know why I didn't do it a while back, but now I'm there.
Well, it's very different from being in your own studio, I imagine.
Yes, but over the years I've taught a lot in my studio, you know, and I've had kids, you know, I've had adults, I've the very special arts when I was younger. I was involved with that. And so I have teaching behind me. Mm-hmm. And the high school students would come over for their extracurricular credits, I guess you would say. And they would work in my studio, so they would be learning then also. So it's kind of a natural migration for me. I've kind of, in a way, through my years, have been a teacher, you know, with my previous jobs that I had and that sort of thing. I taught a lot of people different things. But I love the Art Center, and I love being there. And they're actually going to have the art fair coming up here on this weekend.
That's
actually,
right. That's right.
As we speak.
And you'll have work in the art fair.
Yes, I will. Yes, I will. I'll be in the parking lot in the back by the Monon Trail. And so please come see me.
if I were just beginning to mm-hmm. learn sculpture, how would you orient me? Is there something that do you just immediately have your kids put their hands, kids, students of any age?
No, I had a student in my class just now, and she's 70, and it was the first time she took it. So then she's a kid
so cool.
at heart.
That is so cool. But do you start with, you know, just put your hands in this? This is what you need to know before I give you any intellectual information about it? Or is there a kind of an orientation that you set out with for beginners?
Well, I kind of like to ask them, yeah, stick your hands in it and get used to being dirty, because you're going to get clay all over you. I mean, if you notice, as I came in today, I've got, you know, I just came from class, so I have glaze and you know, pottery remnants all over me.
You know,
right
it
now.
Doesn't show because you're wearing a beautiful shirt with a botanical print on it. So
well, you know, you learn how to disguise
things. The thing you said about organic it holds true.
I want them to just get their hands in it, and then I'll ask them, you know, what is your goal from this? What is it that you want to, what do you want to achieve in this class? And then try and make that happen for them. You know, some people it's about relaxing. A-type personalities want to come in and just let themselves go and not try and do perfection the first time, and they allow themselves to have that freedom of discovering mistakes and how wonderful they can be and enjoy. And then some people come in and they're more focus-driven where, okay, I need to have three bowls. And, you know, two candlestick holders and, you know, or whatever, you know, at the end. So it's really different for each one of the students.
That's why a smaller class size is probably helpful, right?
It does help. I've been fortunate to have a small class, but they grow over time. And actually, the larger classes are really wonderful, too, because then you have such a wide range of talent in the room. You know, so in your classroom, you'll have some very, very talented people, and then you have some beginning people, and you have this great big mosh pit, so to speak, and there you learn so much that way. It's nice for individual instruction if that's really what you want, to be in a small class, but if you really learn by observing and watching people and that sort of thing, a big class is, you've got everything there.
It's all good.
Yeah.
You have a chance to, let's say you have a chance to invite a sculptor whose work you admire to dinner, living, dead, any era.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it?
Ingo Maurer. Ingo Maurer is, he's an artist, he's living, he's German. He has been around for a while. A lot of his pieces are in the Museum of Modern Art. He does a lot of light. He makes lights, and I call it light art. I love art that involves light. Mm. And he mixes his materials and his imagination and his thought process. It's just fascinating to me. It's wonderful. When I was in Milan, when I worked at Form Plus Function, and I was at the Milan Salon, which is going on right now, I met Ingo Maurer there and had the opportunity to see his installation that he had there. And now every year when I get a chance to go to New York for the International Contemporary Furniture Fair, I always go to his showroom and I always say hello to him.
Well, let's work on that dinner invitation. Maybe we can get you two over a meal together.
Sharon Gamble with artist Morgan Bosler.
You can find out more about Morgan and her work at her new website, modurn.com. And there's a hyphen there, so it's modurn.com.
Hey, Travis, did you remember your sunblock?
Of course.
Well, Sharon, you're going to need it this weekend because it's all about the Broad Ripple Art Fair this weekend.
Right. Yeah, definitely bring your sunblock out
there. Bring your sunblock.
Because it's going to be a great weekend out there. And FYI is out there, mm-hmm. and lots of great artists and arts organizations. Always a wonderful time.
And we're going to tell you where there is on our calendar thing that we call
What do we do?
Where is there?
Well, there. the Broad Ripple Art Fair? Basically up at 67th and College at the Indianapolis Arts Center in Broad Ripple. It's their biggest fundraising event. And they have 200, 300 artists from all around the country, as well as a lot of local artists, and great food and entertainment mm-hmm. all day, Saturday and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a must-see, must-do, and I encourage you to get out and take in at least some part of the Broad Ripple Art Fair this weekend.
Yeah, always a good thing. Mm-hmm. Great way to kick off the summer, I always sort mm-hmm. of see that.
Indeed.
Hey, this is for our listeners who are listening on Friday night, because if you're checking us out on Saturday afternoon, you may have just missed this, but it's a pretty important thing I wanted to get on, and it's the NAACP celebrating 100 years with their centennial event. It's a play that they're doing called Breaking Barriers, The Little Rock Nine. It's told from the perspective of the nine students who integrated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. And the play is taking place on Saturday, May 16th at 2 o'clock. It's a one-hour play with reception and a tour of the Crispus Attucks Medical Magnet Auditorium and that whole area afterwards. It's actually at Crispus Attucks School. And it is at 2 p.m. on Saturday the 16th. So if you're listening to our Saturday show, sorry, but you guys just missed it.
Maybe
you were there and it was wonderful, right. And we want to hear about it. Yeah.
Exactly. Art of the Matter at WFYI.org is how to contact us.
There you go.
Hey, Saturday night, Emily Ann Thompson is here as the last performance of this year's Indie Folk Series season. She's a Celtic fiddler who plays Irish, Scottish, Cape Breton, and more tunes. And she is bringing along some friends. It's a little bit of a surprise, according to the organizers of the Indie Folk Series. But that concert is going on Saturday night, May 16th at 7 o'clock at UUI at 615 West 43rd Street. Very casual, kid-friendly, so bring the kids and come on down to hear Emily Ann Thompson and friends. Indie Folk Series, Saturday night.
Sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, our own Matt Sosi is going to be at Easley Winery, that's on College Avenue, on May 17th, Sunday at 1 p.m. He's hosting a film chat about auto racing in cinema that also includes some clips of his favorite film, Car Chases. So it should be a lot of fun. Sociology, wine, races.
We've known Matt for a while, and I wasn't really aware that he had any favorite car chases.
Have you ever driven with Matt? Invented right there.
Well, actually, no. I've been smart enough not to do that, so maybe that's why I don't mm-hmm. know about modern yeah. car chases.
Interesting.
So you might want to have a glass of wine at Easley Winery while you're hearing that. Hey, for something completely different now, the Magdalena Gallery of Art will be presenting an opening reception of the Indiana Artist Show in conjunction with the Carmel Arts District Gallery Walk. Ooh, that's a mouthful. Next Friday evening, May 22nd. And the theme of the evening walk will be an emphasis on, surprise, Indy 500 Race Weekend and welcoming out-of-town visitors to the gallery and to the Carmel area. So that's all going on, and you can find out more about the Carmel Arts District at any browser near you.
There you go. And the last thing I've got is Cabaret at the Connoisseur Room. That's also basically what was the American Cabaret is now going through some very cool changes with some great performers coming in. And in fact, they're doing a special that if you've not been to the new Cabaret yet, they're doing a buy one, get free tickets. If you're a new person, they're so sure that you're going to love it. This is a great way to check it out. In fact, tonight there are some performances that you want to check out. Lee Lissek, Too Marvelous for Words, the songs of Johnny Mercer.
Mm.
And he's going to be singing tonight at 6 p.m. and then also again at 9:30. The Cabaret at the Connoisseur Room, which is located at 127 East Ohio Street, or just go to thecabaret.org.
Neat. One final thing from me. Now is the month of Maine. It's the theme of a concert this Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at Broadway United Methodist Church, 609 East 29th Street, as the title suggests. It is a choral concert dedicated to works related to the season of spring. There's an art display in the church parlor on the same theme. So now is the month of Maine.
Sunday at 4 o'clock at Broadway United Methodist.
Very good. And we will be back next week with lots more things to do. With what do we call it, Sharon?
I think we call it
What Do We Do? Thank you.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
When you mix tap dancing, percussion, a trombone, and a tuba, you get the group the Born Again Floozies. This unique band of men and women has been kicking it old style around Indianapolis and beyond. Matthew Sosi spoke with Floozies Nancy Moore, Joey Welch, and Charlie Crone about their floosiness.
Okay, let me see. Tap dancing, tubas, guitars, trombones, cursing on your albums. How did this get started? Who's responsible for this?
Well,
first one who speaks.
Yeah. Well, it started out as my girlfriend at the time told me she was a tap dancer at one point in her life and studied tap for 12 years. And, you know, at the time I was doing solo gigs where I was stomping on a box, playing a guitar, and making all the noise that I could with any spare limbs.
Very Johnny Hooker type stuff.
Yeah. But not really blues, you know, but
sure.
That kind of vibe. I thought, hell, you know, she can tap dance. We can get a lot more intricate rhythms going, like, mimic a drum set with tap dancing. And so one day I was playing. She went up in the attic and got her tap shoes out, and we marked up the floor for about a couple hours. Then when we our first... I guess tour was in Ireland on a horse-drawn gypsy wagon.
Who's the tougher audience, the Irish or St. Patrick's Day crowds here in the States?
Neither. They're both easy as floozies. I mean, Irish. The Irish are easy.
Like Sunday morning.
No.
Not that easy.
No. They're
okay.
Hungover like Sunday morning. But they. It was a great crowd to play for because I'd start playing. If I had a guitar, that instantly, you know, you walk in with a guitar, they want you to play. Then if they like you, which if you can, I'm convinced if they liked what I was playing after as many pints as I got, they would buy you pints and whatever you bought. So the first time we went in, this one, we were on Clare Island. We went into the one pub there and started playing, and well, before we started playing, my wife bought a shot and a pint of Guinness.
Of course.
And so then I started, I was playing, and second song in, I looked down. There was like the bar wall right there. I looked down, and there are pints.
Can you do that into the microphone?
Sorry. Right along the wall, there's
this
pints.
This is an audio medium, so I'm just...
I know. I get,
sorry.
I get carried away with this storytelling.
Okay. So pint shot. And
pint
you're not
shot.
Keith Moon.
No. I mean, I can hold it. I've learned how to play after pints. They're two separate things. But shots, no, never. So, yeah, that was a very, it was wonderful payment. I just wish I had 12 of my friends there to help me enjoy it.
Nancy and Charlie were shaking their heads in agreement on this. How did you two become floozies?
You became floozies first. Go ahead.
I met Joe a while ago, and a friend of the family told Joe that if he was looking for a backup vocalist to call me, and so I went in and sat in with Joe. And
well, actually, I was thinking of another vocalist, and you were the first person that popped into my mind. Because
I thought Matt Wilson was responsible for that.
No, I asked him how to get a hold of you.
Okay, then yeah. I have no idea.
It was just, she's a fantastic vocalist.
She is.
And
thank you.
When I was thinking of adding another voice, you were the first person that popped into my mind.
Oh, shucks, thanks. So that's how.
Thank you. Glad we got that cleared up, Charlie. Try to be more vague. Can you?
I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, I just popped out of the ether, pretty much. No, Joe and I worked together years ago in a band called Johnny Sacco back in the early '90s.
Where you were adding horns to every conceivable song known to man.
Mm-hmm. Yes, most all of them.
Rick Springfield, especially.
Oh, good God.
Yeah. Well, actually, written by Sam. I remember you guys doing I've Done Everything for You.
Oh, okay. That's after I was.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That was part of
Mach 2?
That was
Sorry.
Johnny Mako.
Wow.
Them fighting words.
Did I say that out loud?
I'm afraid you did. You got to work on that inner monologue.
Button.
Jeez.
No.
I didn't really say that.
No.
You didn't. That's all right.
Who's going to hear it?
Right.
Hey.
No, I meant that as... Man. I was being facetious. It's going out on radio.
Religion has nothing to do with this. All right.
There's actually a little bit more to the story about how I got in the band.
Okay. No, please do, because we need to dodge the... East Coast, West Coast thing that could happen now.
Yeah, I hear you, yeah. I'll throw up a couple of signs and keep going.
Okay.
Joe asked me if I would write a couple of charts for a recording session we did in Chicago, 2 years ago now?
Yeah.
Coming up on 2 years ago. And I said, sure, I'll write a couple of charts for you. And he said, hey, would you mind playing on those charts on the recording? I said, sure, I'll play on those charts. And he said, would you mind playing on a couple other songs? You'll find out about them when we get there. And I said, sure. And then he said, you know, you should probably just be in the band. And I said, okay. And here I am.
How junior high of it.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
It's very junior high because all the bands I've ever started have always been revolved around meeting someone who is interesting, cool, and talented in some way, and then building a band around those talents.
Hello, Nancy.
Hi.
There you go.
It's like, hey, let's put on a show.
Pretty much. It's now Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. Only with tap dancing.
What other good reason is there other than to hang out with people you like and do something that's creative and fun and
create corporate anthems, make money, lots and lots and lots of money. That's why.
Yeah,
that's what you can do.
We excel at that, don't we?
Are we in the same band? What?
Joe, you didn't tell me.
You guys are right over there?
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Okay.
How, and of course, the live show and the music is unlike anything I've heard in this city or well, elsewhere for that matter. How do you guys rehearse? Nance, do you tap as well?
No, I'm not tapping.
You should.
Oh, well, I have a whole lot of other stuff that I'm doing. So.
Such as?
I play a 40-inch orchestral bass drum.
Carefully.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A big gong, which, you know, you can borrow if you want for your show anytime.
Oh, thank you.
And I have
a 3 foot
giant.
Do you also announce blood sport matches in your spare time?
We are all about the blood sport. Mm-hmm. It's a musical blood sport.
And isn't that the rock opera you folks are going to be working on next?
Exactly, yes.
I bleed frequently.
Yeah, even though I tap danced, you know, since I was five, I'm kind of singing and playing, learning more percussive things with my hands instead of my feet. So it's interesting. I've been learning a lot. You know, I have sung in a kajillion cover bands and hit the tambourine. So I still play the tambourine, but it's a lot on a bigger scale now. So
is it a bigger tambourine?
It's a different tambourine. It's an orchestral tambourine.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Very serious.
Yes.
Very organic.
Yes. And I hit a tambourine on a trash can lid during one song. So
So do you guys challenge Stomp to a basketball game?
I don't play sports, but...
That was metaphorical,
I know,
really.
I'm teasing.
No, that's okay. So how do you guys write music together?
Well, I usually... What we've done in the past is I write the song, I record the demo.
That makes the whole world sing. Sorry.
No. That's that song.
It's too easy.
Bert's good, but I'm not a huge Bacharach fan. That wasn't... I like that very man.
I got it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway.
Good reference.
Yes. Whenever I can rope in Barry Manilow.
Bert Bacharach.
And Bert. We get together and we hash out an arrangement. In the past I've done a lot of the arranging in a demo, handed it to everybody else, everybody learns it. But we took for this next record that we're getting ready to do, we're doing it differently. We had a 3-day retreat in the woods in a lake house. It was really a lot of fun.
A lot of fires and marches.
No, we didn't
and
have
grunting
time to make any fire.
Expressing your feelings.
No, it wasn't anything like that.
This wasn't a promise.
A musical retreat.
Expressing your feelings, but
okay.
I had about 120 something songs to sort through and just pick. We had this big backdrop lined up on a wall about the size of that there, about 10 feet by 8 feet, and everybody took their favorite song lyrics out of the pile of 120 and put them up on the wall, and then we voted, and our goal was to get it down to like 15, but I think we wound up with 36.
Was it over 30?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like 36, and then that's not counting the other demos that we have, so we still have some whittling down to do, but it's always better to have more than... I don't know.
Double album.
Yeah,
we just leave to double live album.
Is there? Yeah, we're still gonna stick with albums because everybody else is kind of bucking that and just releasing.
I'm sorry, a collection of songs in some form of unit is an album.
Is an album,
yes,
like
yes,
a
thank
so
you.
Group of photos.
So I think you have. I think you have enough for your physical graffiti.
Yeah.
Or metaphysical graffiti if you're in the Dead Milkmen.
My favorite. Bozo.
So as far as doing demos, I mean, it's not like you're making the tappers tap for hours and hours on end just to get the rhythm right.
Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of time we were, we always try to push boundaries, especially musical boundaries and the way we look at different instruments like a tap dancer. We've been combining, kick drum. We have 4 bass drums that we play on stage. One's kind of like a kick drum to a drum set. I play that while I'm playing guitar and singing. And Nancy plays 2 of the orchestral ones. And then we got this big 1920s marching bass drum that Amy, our tap dancer, plays. And we're working on creating, percussive patterns. And we might pick a style and kind of work off that. Like we picked the beat to "Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster."
For you Office Space fans out there.
Yeah. So by the Ghetto Boys, I believe. But we picked that beat, and then we decided we're going to take this beat and we're going to mirror it, or try to pattern a tap dance orchestral percussion pattern on that.
So you're reverse sampling is basically what you're
doing. We're taking it back.
Great, now we're going to have the Ghetto Boys, Born Again Floozies rivalry. You've already sparked 2 rivalries in 1 interview.
And it's early in the day.
It is.
Yeah. Troublemakers.
East Coast, West Coast.
East side, West side.
North versus South soon. It'll be Civil War all over again.
Floozies gang sign. We need to work on that.
No. Maybe, but not here. We like our new building. Let it be.
Well, we were recording in Chicago with Steve Albini, and I felt like a complete...
Careful.
Yeah. Uninformed youth. We were walking in, and he said, somebody tagged the building again. And I'm looking, tagged? What, like a... Is that like a... parking ticket? What? He just looked at me like, where do you live? I don't have TV. I don't know. I don't know.
Matt Sophie with the Born Again Floozies. To learn more about the Floozies, go to, you guessed it, bornagainfloozies.com, and you can hear them live at Radio Radio on May 30th. Here's a sample from their latest album, The Born Again Floozies, with Street Music.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. I'll chat with the Symphony's Simon Crookall about the upcoming onstage ball.
I'll talk with WFYI's own Jim Simmons about his Creative Renewal Fellowship.
And then I get to meet Yo-Yo King, Mitch Camisato. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call.
What'll we do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.